Okay, well, good afternoon, everyone. My name is Ryan Kelsey. I'm one of the co-chairs of this seminar, along with Frank Moretti, who sends his regrets today for not being able to attend. It's with great pleasure that we have Warren Sack here today to talk with us about technologies of community conversation by design. I'll just do the briefest of brief introductions and get right to the presentation. Warren is here visiting from the University of California at Santa Cruz. Right now he, I believe, is a affiliated faculty with the ICER group, is that right? Is that what you're
referring to? Yeah, external faculty.
Sorry, external faculty. I hadn't heard that before. But ICER is I'm going to get this right, Institute for Social and Economic Research and Policy, if you're not aware of who they are. And within that is the Center on Organizational Innovation, and that's the center where Warren is hanging out when he's here at Columbia. You can see all of his Santa Cruz affiliations up on this slide here, so I won't try to reproduce them. But today we're going to be talking about MetaVid, which is a project that's being worked on at the Social Computing Lab at UCSC, and how that might answer the question, can new media technologies be designed to engender community rather than to undermine it? Or, as he says here, how should network public spaces be designed? So, Warren, take it away.
You know, we're not that many people. Would people mind just going around and say your name and where you're coming from so I know a little bit more and I get at least kind of meet you?
Maurice, would you mind?
Yeah, Maurice, please.
Mark Phillips in CCNMTL in the English department.
I'm Ainsley Evans. I'm at the computing and ed program at Teachers College.
Mm-hmm. Dan Lynchworth. I'm a grad student in the writing program.
Leslie Klein in the architecture school.
Fabrizio Pagliaro. I teach business school in Spain. I'm a visiting the year in the business school. Ken Lowe. I'm a graduate fellow, which is specifically in the high school.
Thank you. Well, Ryan said I should only talk for about half an hour, so I'm going to skip my previous work. But what I want to do is just outline what I think is a problem, the loss of public space, an approach to that problem, which I call discourse architecture, and then give an example, MetaVid, which is an example of designing for for a conversation. So the point that I'm trying to make is that actually rather than designing for communities per se, it might be more specific and functional to design for conversations. And I guess the implicit thing that I have here as well is that I think that right now, conversations online constitute a very important part of our public space and our public discussion, and that my preference would be that they get archived at universities rather than as they are now at Google and other private companies. So that's kind of my thing here. My previous work, we've done things, GPS devices for allowing people to leave their stories either around San Francisco or World War II veterans around Guam and Iwo Jima. Conversation map is what I did for my PhD dissertation at MIT, just mapping out big discussions. We'll see some more of these things. Agonistics was a sort of newer version of this, mapping out new online discussions. And this was shown in an art venue. So this is the ZKM in Karlsruhe, Germany. But I'm going to get right to my talk. In the United States, public space is splintering into shards. Due to poor urban planning, we've lost most of what sociologist Ray Oldenburg calls our third places, our easily accessible places of community. Some of us still know these places as pubs, bars, cafes, and other neighborhood institutions where conversation between friends and strangers is facilitated. But most of us have lost third places to highways, suburbanization, and shopping malls. We've also lost, according to the political scientist Robert Putnam, much of our social capital, that is, our acquaintance with our neighbors and thus our ability to mobilize and collectively act together. Putnam ties this loss to a collapse of institutions of civil society. Americans don't know their neighbors and have ceased to be joiners, so we no longer see one another at club meetings, sports events, or even informal gatherings. Moreover, Ben Bandikian shows us that the loss of public space is not just an issue of physical space. The problem is also a loss of media space, especially the spaces of journalism. So new media technologies can be destructive forces in this shattering of public space. After World War II, Americans bought television sets and from then on tended to increasingly stay home to watch rather than go out and participate in civic life. Even media technologies designed to support two-way communication rather than just one-way transmission have frequently been exacerbated rather than address the problem of public space. Some like radio, which in principle can be two-way, have been made one-way. Others like cell phones and computer networks are predominantly employed to reinforce and thus circumscribe existing family and social networks rather than opening them up to public interchange. So when you get a new cell phone, who are the people that you call first? They're your family and your friends. They're not some random stranger. It's not an opening into a bigger public. It's sort of a tightening down. Oftentimes new technologies are a tightening down of our immediate social networks. So in the 1960s, the French artist and theorist Guy Debord said it most concisely when he stated that new technologies tend to isolate people from one another. Conversely, new media technologies can be constructive. For instance, in his book Imagined Communities, Benedict Anderson argues persuasively that the social formation we now know as the nation state would have been impossible without the 19th century invention of the high-speed printing press, which in turn provided technological underpinnings for the large distribution daily newspaper. So one might understand these contradictory constructive and deconstructive forces of new media technologies by contextualizing them in a larger ecology of media. In the media ecology in the US has been overwhelmed by the ubiquity of private communications. This is the diagnosis for Western Europe of Jürgen Habermas, Hannah Arendt, and many others. The private and the social have driven out the public. One might venture that the cause of the symptom is the people using the media technologies. So we might posit, along with Richard Sennett, the, quote, fall of public man, an increasing interest in personal psychology, overwhelming priority of the public, and the political realms in our lives. But to explain this unbalance between public and private as due strictly to social forces is to forget the powers, even agency, that some of these new media technologies have. Instead, we might remember one of Marshall McLuhan's subtler points that he cribbed from Winston Churchill. Now, Churchill commented on the discipline of architecture when he said, "We shape our buildings, and then they shape us." And McLuhan's parallel construction concerned media. We make our media, and then they make us. So McLuhan's point is that there's a mutually recursive relationship between the new media technologies and our communities. Each influences the other. The circular relationship between media technologies and communities would, in a more conventional philosophical vocabulary, be termed dialectics. But this only fits if we remember the etymology of dialectics, which in ancient Greek referred to the art of discussion. We might then say that any discussion, exchange, collaboration, or competition that takes place within a given media technology does so within a context where the technology is a conversant or even a moderator of the conversation. So this way of framing the problematic of media technology design, that is to understand design as a construction of conversations and conversants, was incompletely described in Terry Winograd and Fernando Flores's 1987 book entitled Understanding Computers and Cognition, A New Foundation for Design. So in that book, Winograd and Flores make a series of key points. Any organization is constituted as a network of recurrent conversations. Conversations are linked in regular patterns of triggering and breakdown. In creating tools, we're designing new conversations and connections. And computers are tools for conducting the network of conversations. Now, this is incomplete for several reasons. Their focus was on work-based situations in which conversations were action-based. Thus, their method of design is referred to as a language action perspective on the design of cooperative work. But nevertheless, recent insights complement this approach. Especially important for understanding the labor economics of an information society is the complementary work of the Italian autonomists, in particular the work of Paolo Verno, Antonio Negri, Maurizio Lazzarato. Within this framework, we can begin to understand that not just action-based, business-oriented conversations are a form of labor, but how a huge range of phatic conversations, greeting, empathy, comfort, are forms of immaterial labor. Paolo Verno summarizes this approach to understanding conversation as work in his book entitled A Grammar of the Multitude. Verno writes, "Today, wage labor," this is his book, "is interaction. The labor process is no longer taciturn but loquacious. The dialogical word is seated at the very heart of capitalist production. In short, to understand fully the rules of post-Fordist labor, it's necessary to turn more and more to Saussure and Wittgenstein. It's true that these authors lost interest in the social relations of production. Nevertheless, they reflected so deeply on linguistic experience, they have more to teach us about the loquacious factory than do the professional economists." So this is, you know, really trying to think through things like what kind of work is being performed behind the counter at, let's say, McDonald's when they greet you with a smile and say, "Hi, how are you?" The idea of the loquacious factory, the chat factory, the factory of conversational interaction, or what the Italian autonomists have called elsewhere the factory without walls, provides a framework for understanding how productive work for large corporate concerns is accomplished by independent individuals performing activities that they personally consider leisure activities. So this pushes it even farther away from just the white collar and the service worker. Tiziana Terranova, in her book Network Culture, Politics for the Information Age, takes these insights into the terrain of the Web 2.0 economy in order to understand how businesses like Google and Yahoo are sustained by the immaterial free labor, the conversational contributions of millions of non-employees building web pages, posting personal photos, uploading videos, and engaging in online discussions. And I think the insight can be extended even further. One can rightly understand not just business organizations, but almost any social or cultural institution as a set of initiating, recurrent, and sustaining conversations. And I propose a vision of technologies and institutions, be they civil, corporate, or personal, as sets of recurrent conversations between peoples and things. So, to summarize my presentation so far, I want to give a short answer to the question posed by the title, "How should network public spaces be designed?" My answer is that we should design these network technologies by considering the kinds of conversations that they enable or destroy. And this kind of design is what my colleagues Tom Erickson at IBM Watson and Susan Herring at Indiana University and I have called discourse architecture. Discourse architecture entails three kinds of work. First, analyses to reveal the patterns of conversation. Second, the design of new media technologies to facilitate patterns of conversation. And third, recurrently, an excavation and an evaluation to understand the patterns of conversation presupposed, supported, or unsupported by existing technologies. So what should we be designing as information technologies for a community? My students, colleagues, and I have been attempting to address this question for the last few years, but I want to start with a short description of the sort of conversational analysis work that we've done. We closely look at what Winograd and Flores calls the network of recurrent conversations that take place at the site of our potential software design intervention. And so I'm going to give you four examples of very distinctive patterns of online discussion. All of them are taken from online threaded discussions, and so the unit of analysis, so to speak, is the discussion thread. The discussion thread is constituted from an initial message, and then all the replies to the initial message, all the replies to the replies, and so on. So discussion threads can differ according to the number of structural, linguistic, and social measures, including, for example, the number of messages in the thread, the number of people participating, that is, posting messages to the thread, the manner in which the conversation branches into parallel flows of discussion or not, who quotes whom in the thread, and so on. So we usually see discussion threads like this in our inbox, but we might equally graph them radially like this. This is from my conversation map work, where really the initial post is in the middle, and then every message connected, line connected to it, is a reply, and reply to reply, and so forth. So the thumbnail, we can do this with thumbnails as well. So if we look at a whole bunch of threads at once, here's 423 threads from a news group. And just look at the shapes here. So some of them are complex, but some of them are very simple. They're just simple lines, which would indicate sort of a post and a reply, and that's the end, right? Versus something like this. Here's 130 thumbnails from another news group. All very involved. Well, not all, but many very involved. So given an iconography like the radial plot employed by the conversation map, what does an online discussion look like if it's dominated by question and answer exchanges? So I did an analysis for Sun, for the Java developers forums, where they have a lot of people who come there, very pragmatic. They're trying to solve a problem. They pose a question. They said, how do I do this in Java? And they want to find an answer to it. So the good stuff in these forums are the questions and answers. How do you find questions and answers? Sun asked me automatically. Well, it's really pretty straightforward. First, look for the short threads, because the long threads are not going to be a simple question and answer. They're going to be like an extended discussion. And then find participants who frequently end threads rather than start short threads. So what you're looking for are the question answerers. Who are the question answerers? Well, they're the ones who post in short threads at the end of the thread. They're not questioned by someone else. So a question answering looks like that a lot of times. So my second example is work I've been doing for the last 5 years with colleagues at INRIA in France. We've been closely analyzing the conversational exchanges that take place within open source software design discussions. To outline the pattern of these conversations, we need to look at a few more aspects of the discussion. First, we note that conversations can be characterized according to play between participants' assigned roles and performed roles. This is akin to what, for example, in Gray-Mossian semiotics distinguishes attentional and thematic roles. So thematic roles are ones that are independent of the narrative, right? You can recognize a fisherman because of the gear he carries. But attentional roles are imbricated in the narrative. You can't pick out the hero from one still of a film. You need to know what the whole narrative is. So the assigned roles in a design discussion like this are like who's leading the design for a particular part, who leads the whole project, who's in charge of coding it, things like that. And then the performed roles are what you see happening online. Like how do these things play out? How do people participate in the discussions and in the coding? So in our project, we're looking at the specific project of Python, a programming language designed as open source software. There's a project leader, there are administrators, there are champions of particular changes to the language, and the developers. The performed roles, you can think of it as they initiating a branch in the discussion, they end the discussion, they quote others, they're quoted by others. Someone like a question asker or a question answerer, again, that would be another kind of performed role. And if you label these threads with sort of the roles, the assigned roles, what you begin to see are a variety of patterns that come out. The assigned roles do very much correspond in various ways with the performed roles. So we see significant correlations. You can see regularities, like we've got a triangle down here at the bottom left, triangle, a square, triangle, a square, triangle, a square. That's a back and forth between an administrator and a developer, you know, sort of back and forth kinds of things. We see the star, the champion of an idea, sort of very key, initiating things, finalizing things, summarizing things. We do this for a variety of discussions, and we come up with sort of findings like the project leader and the champion are frequent contributors and post messages that lead to multiple branches in the discussions. And other people, if they post something and they don't branch out, usually. The champion is the only discussant who writes syntheses of what's been said. So that's, you can't just go and say, oh, well, this is what the whole discussion has been about without having a kind of assigned role. So let me just go on to a third example. What's political debate look like? If that is sort of post-industrial discussion, how can we look at a news group and figure out where some kind of deliberative exchange is happening? People with very different political positions are talking to one another. What do those look like? Again, it's a little bit like tea leaf readings, but that's what all kinds of structuralism are in various kinds of humanities and social sciences. And you can get something out of this. So what we found, pretty much to try and find deliberative exchanges in news groups, is find the threads where you have one or more frequent posters, so people who come back again and again. You don't just get the people who fly in, like spit something out and fly out and you never see them again. That's not going to give you a nice deliberation. Frequent, people who come back. Find threads where no one person dominates, so you want everybody to be heard. Find threads that have at least one message with multiple replies. So you had at least one message that sparked like a bunch of replies. And then find threads where everyone has posted a few messages. So there's a nice distribution there as well. If you get, you know, something that has a few different people, but the most of the thread is dominated by one person just going ad hominem, that's not going to be a good deliberation. So this is what they oftentimes look like. They look like that second group of thumbnails that I showed you. Not the simple post-reply, but sort of things like this. Now, my fourth example is kind of, and this is where we get to, I think, the milieu of MetaVid, the system that I want to demo for you in a second. You know, unfortunately, our national political debate is better characterized not as deliberation and debate, but as polemics. And polemics are difficult to visualize as conversations because they're almost the antithesis of conversation. It's people not replying to one another. So this is a particular thing from a well-known paper by Lotta Adamek and Natalie Glantz entitled The Political Blogosphere and the 2004 U.S. Election, Divided They Blog. So if you're a red poster, all you link to on your blog are other reds. If you're a blue poster, all you're linking to are other blues. And there's a little bit of yellow. That does mean there's a little exchange between Democrats and Republicans, right and left, in the blogosphere, but very little. Valdis Krebs did another nice thing, totally different way of visualizing this polemic. He looked at the best-selling political books sold on Amazon. You know, you can get Amazon. If you go to Amazon, you look up a book, it says, people who bought this book also bought this book. And you can get access as a developer to all that data from Amazon's databases. And what he plots out is, okay, look at all on the left side, those are all blue books. And on the right-hand side, those are all red books. And then you got a couple of purples in the middle, but very few. So the thing is, people either buy to one side or the other. They're not reading both sides. It's a little disheartening. Except here's a third picture of polemics that I think gives some reason for hope. And this is Fernanda Viegas and Martin Wattenberg's analysis of edit wars on Wikipedia. And this is a particular picture of abortion. It's a profile from 2001 to 2003. The different colors are different people contributing. And you can see whether or not their contributions last or get cut off. And when you see a big wiggly line like this, this means that there's huge deletes. Like one set of people are just deleting the other people's content and replacing it with their own. And so a really vicious one, in fact, goes back and forth, up and down, up and down. But the reason why I read this and I see some hope in it is if you go to Wikipedia, there's a production there that's actually happening, right? I mean, there's a resource that people are building despite these polemics. And I think it has something to do with the architecture of Wikipedia. Now, Fernanda and Martin, I just went up there to give them a talk. They both work at the IBM Visual Culture Lab, Visual Communication Lab. And they noted that you no longer see these things on Wikipedia, that is to say, the edit wars with the big zigzags, because Wikipedia has changed their architecture slightly, so that if you delete someone else's contribution three times, that's it. You don't get any more. You can't delete it anymore. And so all the edit wars have gone away in some ways. And they analyzed all this stuff, and they looked at it and said, where did all the edit wars go? And so they said, we must have made a mistake. So they did it again, and then they noticed this thing. So it's little tiny architectural details that suddenly like mess up the polemics. I don't know if that's a bad thing, but it seems something, it seems censorious to kind of cut people off like that. So hopefully these four illustrations of different patterns of conversation provide some insight into my proposal to critique technology according to the kinds of discussion it does or does not facilitate, and to propose an alternative set of technologies for networked public spaces. So now I want to turn to one such proposal currently under development at my research lab by Afid Stern and Michael Dale, who used to be students of mine. They got their master's degree doing this project, but then we found funding from the Sunlight Foundation to continue it. So they're research scientists at UC Santa Cruz. I think, I don't know. This is what I'd like to discuss with you. Is this, what kinds of archives, what kinds of systems do we need to be designing for a world of polemics, a world of post-dialectics? So, Menavid, in a nutshell, is an archive and searchable index of the U.S. Senate and House floor proceedings available on the web at menavid.org. It's up and running right now. It's an open access archive of video and associated metadata from the U.S. House and Senate floor proceedings. And Menavid is open source and patent free from the ground up. The archive contains open content from the public domain. So what we're trying to really address this way is, Afid puts it this way, it's sort of, content can be enclosed online in a variety of ways, technological, physically, and legally, and we're trying to address these all at once. So if you look at the way C-SPAN archives some of the same footage, all three of these strategies of enclosure have been deployed, at least until recently. Real video, it's accessible via Real Video, but Real Video is a proprietary media format. Physical, you can't get at the access to the archives. We're trying to put everything up on the web. And then legal, the sort of licensing agreements limit the usage rights. And so we're trying to address all three of these things at once. So here's what one of the interfaces to Medavid looks like, but I'll show you a little bit more in depth. We more or less have five interfaces to Medavid. One is for the citizen to sort of search and watch clips. Let's say you want to see what Hillary Clinton had to say about life insurance. You can find that kind of stuff. Something a little bit more complicated, you're a blogger, you want to pull out a particular section of video, and you want to comment on it, and you want that video to run on your content management system in your blog. We have sort of solution for that. You're a media producer. How do you download high-resolution versions of this stuff to include in a video, a film, make sequences of videos, video clips? A little more complicated than is the application programmer, where you might want to use the API to build alternative or complementary websites or mash up what's there with other websites. And then finally, the platform developer, copying the architecture for other projects. Today we've had very little of the last, although the City Council of Missoula, Montana has done a little experimentation with just copying Medavid and doing their stuff, and the Parliament of the country of the National Parliament of Kenya in Africa is building something that uses a lot of Medavid component. So I'm not going to get necessarily into all this. I think the easiest way to sort of do this is just to kind of demo a little bit here now. So, citizen interface. We go to the Medavid site and we say, okay, what has Dennis Kuchinik said? We just search for anything that's said by him. We get back a list of stuff. We want to find out Hillary Clinton, what has she said? We get little pieces here.
I want to thank my colleague from Washington for her usual, very thorough and persuasive statement on the floor about the need for flexibility in this important program.
That's sort of one look at it. You just want to search and find stuff and watch them. Now, another thing you might want to do, see if you're a media producer, this is gonna double for the blogger interface and the media producer interface. Let's say we're just trying we can embed this kind of sequence in a blog. If I click on E here, so let's say I find something that I like, then all I have to do is copy this. It's a little piece of JavaScript and HTML, and just plunk it into my my blog. Let me see. Right, so then you just end up something like this. This is an example of just dumping it into Blogger or Blogspot, and it runs just fine from here. So that's what you might want to do as a blogger. And this comes in sort of various flavors for a blogger. Let's say you just want the clip your HTML that you're going to be able to just cut and paste. It's going to look something like this. Let's say you want it with some controls on it. There's a little bit more to it. If you want a sequence like I was showing before that has three clips, again, here's the HTML that you include in the page. If you want something more like an RSS feed, you can more or less specify a static search, and it will go and grab that stuff for you. And then finally, if you're using something like a well, this one would be, the M3U would be for something like if you wanted to watch it in iTunes or something like that, a playlist like that. And then this is for a more for a wiki, this kind of HTML that you'd see. But most of that pretty much gets automatically generated. So let me go back to the sequence test here. This is just a wiki page, right? So everything, the interesting thing about this design is that the back end of the whole thing is the same stuff that gets used for Wikipedia, MediaWiki. So if I edit this, what I end up with, so here's my timeline. I can rearrange stuff. I can add some new stuff in, so if I want some house footage to go with that, I can find it here. I drag it down an arrow onto the timeline. I can zoom on the timeline. I can do it all sort of online here, and when I'm done, then it's going to spit out a little piece of HTML that I can then put in my my blog. Now, we've got also a working arrangement with archive.org so that we're not storing all this footage in multiple formats, but archive.org is. So what I'm showing you today actually is sort of the latest version of things. If you notice the URL, it's mvprime, it's not metavid. So I'll give you that URL again, but Michael just finished this on Friday. So we've got a couple things from the old that don't show up in the new, but that will be there again. But you can usually just next to a clip, you can click on it and say, okay, go snag it from the archive.org, you know, the MPEG-4 version of it. Now the final version of this, and this I think has the potential for really turning this into a kind of Wikipedia sort of project. This is called the Stream View. Here is the closed captioning of all the stuff that's being said online. This is sort of, this color bar is just codes for the first 20 minutes or so of this stream. Many times they go on for hours, right? We can edit things. So let's say this isn't really Harry Reid, this is Hillary Clinton speaking. And I got, let's say, the in and out points slightly wrong. And